Welcome everybody. today we'll start chapter 4 in book 2 part 1 of The Life Divine. And in this entire section we've covered a number of chapters so far. fielding the problem of knowledge. So we see that in all these chapters that we've covered, Sri Aurobindo has been introducing sets of dualities, and these dualities pertain to our experience in the world and the way the categories through which we experience this world, our experience. So we found that each one of these he resolves, as it were, on the ground of his initial premise, which is that the one conscious being is infinite and exists both as a essential infinite unitary undivided spaceless and timeless reality, as well as a force that can put its infinite potential into relation with its own self-constituents, so that the simultaneous coexistence of the One and its infinite properties are, you know, the two realities through which the One experiences itself. So its entire infinity is deployed. It is not merely static, but it is deployed in relational and temporal ways. So when we talk about temporal ways, then we come to our experience, which is an experience bounded within time and also bounded in space. So Sri Aurobindo looks at this experience and the fact that we do not have a connection, so it seems, with the undivided and unitary infinity of being. But that we experience this divided world and the relations, which are relations within the divided world, relations of fragmentation. So we find that we need to make sense of this paradoxical situation, which we intuit, because in our knowledge of this experience, we have different levels of understanding and experiencing. This knowledge is not merely mental. And in this way of dealing with this cosmos and our experience in the cosmos, the primary faculty that we employ to describe it to ourselves and to others, to make sense of it, is the mind. And what an undercurrent throughout whatever we have studied so far is the fact that due to the primary property of the mind to think in contradictions and separate contradictions, since they cannot be true at the same time, we arrive at a certain kind of abstract understanding of our experience, which does not in fact fully describe that experience. And yet it becomes a constraint upon our understanding. And so we end up with this paradoxical situation, and we cannot put into proper context our experience, and nor can we understand how to deal with this experience in an individual and collective sense. So Sri Aurobindo's employment of this understanding to work out the relations for the mind, and also to give a certain kind of orientation through our changed understanding to our lives, is what these chapters are all about. And so the dualities, as we see, that he has fielded, first started with the indeterminates and determinability. So then he moved on to the cosmic determinations, indeterminates and the cosmic determinations, the whole field of determinability. And then he moved on to the three stations of the Brahman, Purusha and Ishvara, the undifferentiated and impersonal reality of consciousness, and its personalized entry into the cosmos and into each individual. And this lays the stage for the third chapter, which we just finished, which has to do with the eternal and the individual. And by the eternal and the individual, again, he introduces the three stations of the transcendental, the universal, and the individual. And here we see that in a lot of these there are three terms involved, but if we look carefully, we'll also see that there are two terms which are resolved by the third term. And in this case we find that the individual and the cosmic or the universal are such a differentiation, such a contradiction, almost, it seems. Each seems to have a reality of its own, and it is not merely a contradiction in thought, it is also a contradiction in experience and in becoming. Since we find ourselves confronted by something that we experience in a fragmentary way, but also that seems to have a coherence to it, which is the cosmos or the universe. So, how do we resolve this? And this is what Sri Aurobindo has tried to do in the previous chapter, by showing that the same transcendental is self-presented as the cosmos as well as individuals in the dimension of time, so that there is a certain kind of wholeness, contextual wholeness to the cosmos, and that there is a certain kind of, on the other hand, a seeming fragmentariness to the individual, bounded both in terms of a life, having its limits in life, in birth and death, and the finite space that we occupy within this cosmos. So it brings the whole question of the orientation and evolution of consciousness in the individual. And one may say that thoughts of the kind that he has introduced in that last chapter are also related to the way in which we try to understand how we can move to a collective life in which the cosmos is experienced in a certain identity with the individual. And that becoming of the human, that self-becoming, is in a way the whole meaning of this self-presentation in terms of a world or cosmos, a world of relations, and the entities that participate in that relation. I'd like to mention in passing that contemporary philosophers have also tried to grapple with this problem. And particularly in our time, one of the factors that has made this entire issue of the cosmos and the individual so much more pressing for our understanding is the fact that we live in a world that we have integrated technologically, that we are actually in some sense much more conscious of the cosmos as a whole, because our perception is mediated by global technologies. It is being brought to us all the time, this interdependence of the cosmos, the fact that individuals collectively constitute the cosmos along with the entire gamut of cosmic beings. So that's where we find that some of these ideas that Sri Aurobindo is talking about are being inflected in certain other ways, we may say, including the idea of a certain evolution that is occurring through individuals, through creatures that are relating themselves to the cosmos, found, as it were, by necessity as a kind of opposing medium. And we adapt to that opposing medium. We adapt using various senses. Life tends to evolve these adaptations so that we make ourselves more and more equal to this confrontation with the cosmos. At the human level, this particular adaptation becomes much more universal due to the deployment of technology. Technology becomes our means to extend our relationality and our adaptability at a cosmic level. It becomes cosmic in that sense. So we find that that also has severe problems connected with it. And these problems are related to, again, the perception of the mind under which our life is experienced. And that perception of the mind creates these abstract oppositions that make it difficult for us to really move towards the solution to the oppositions. From the viewpoint of the mediation of technology, some philosophers today talk about the cosmos as the pre-individual. The pre-individual. It's like a kind of an amorphous context or soup, if you want to call it that, out of which the individual is emerging and with which the individual is constantly in connection, absorbing or assimilating more and more of itself, so that we may say that the cosmos is becoming individual. It's the individuation of the cosmos that is taking place. And this self-individuation of the cosmos is occurring through its entities. So each entity, each individual, is becoming the cosmos, as well as the cosmos is becoming an individual through that entity. This is the relationship, in a sense, and this relationship is mediated through our relations and our extensions through technology. So the whole question arises as to how we can look upon these mediations as something positive and as something that we need to, purify so that we can arrive at a cosmic becoming, what is called a cosmogenesis. And the answer is, as we can see over here, the fact that at some deep level, We are the cosmos. Each individual is the cosmos. And it is this realization that the transcendental has become the cosmos and the individual and put these into relation with each other that allows us to find that point of unity. If we can in experience find that point of unity, we can bring that into our relations. And at a collective level, we can find that that cosmogenesis is occurring both individually and collectively. I think this is kind of the drift of Sri Aurobindo's message through these chapters. And in this new chapter, chapter 4, he's introducing a new duality, the duality of the divine and the undivine. If we look at the progression of these chapters, we see that there is a certain connection from chapter to chapter. And the connection unfolds. So if we are talking about the individual and the cosmos, we naturally come to another kind of concern, which is the concern of the divine and the undivine. In other words, what are we to do with this process of individuation when we are making decisions all the time regarding choices of what is appropriate and what is not appropriate? And these choices have to do with a certain verticality. They have to do with an evolution towards the divine. And so this, what is the divine and what is the undivine? Is there an undivine? Or is it just a ignorance? This is a very big question. Is it just that, again, our mental perceptions have created a certain abstract duality due to which we take certain things as undivine, while actually everything is the divine? Now, we do know that, again, the categories that Sri Aurobindo has established and the tradition out of which he is kind of emerging and expressing is the Vedantic tradition. And the primary precept of the Vedantic tradition, which underlies this entire text, is that there is only one being, one conscious being, and that is the divine. So what is the undivine in that case? How can there be an undivine? And yet for our practical relations and our journey upward towards the divine, we find that we have to accept that there is something that we need to reject. The question of rejection comes in. Is this rejection only a temporary rejection? Is it only a practical rejection that needs to be at some point re-assimilated rather than rejected? Or is it a rejection of something that does not need to exist in the cosmos? Is it also something that the cosmos is rejecting in its own temporal evolution? Is it an artifact? Is it something that came to arise due to certain perceptions? All these questions come to our mind, and thinkers are divided about what kind of reality is constituted by the what we may call the undivine. You know, some will say there is nothing undivine. It is only our ignorance that makes it seem undivine. And some will say that there is a kind of a really strong duality between the divine and the undivine. When we go back to the Vedas, we see that the Vedas field very prominently the battle of the Devas and the Asuras, the gods and the demons. We also see that certain other traditions which are based on the Vedic have in some cases made a very trenchant divide and made that the basis of their entire philosophy. Zoroastrianism, for example, is based on the fight between the divine and the undivine, which is going on in the cosmos. So other philosophies have contested this idea that this battle between the devas and the asuras is in fact only a seeming. It is not real. Because if there is only one, how can there be this duality? So this is one of the big issues that Sri Aurobindo is tackling over here. And coming from a Vedantic tradition, he affirms the oneness of all things, the divinity of all things, and yet he sees the absolute reality of this dichotomy and the need for us to make progress, evolve consciously by struggling with that which is ignorant and that which is false, that which is the undivine. So I think with that, if there are any questions, comments, we can discuss it and then move on.
Can you expand a little on the example that you gave about Zoroastrianism and its basis on this exploration of the divine and the undivine as separate entities?
Yeah, Zoroastrianism and some of its offshoots, which actually had a very prominent influence on the ancient world, continues to some extent in Christianity, has the whole idea about kind of absolute realities of good and evil, that there is an evil that is struggling with the good, and we have to accept the good and reject the evil. So for them, the duality is primary. The duality is not a appearance or a secondary reality. And so that leads to a certain very great difficulties that they don't fully solve, but instead what happens is that their philosophy, which is based on the sun and the fire, actually has a lot of similarities with Vedic thinking, but underplays the unity of all, the pre-existent unity of all things. Rather, it gives a lot more emphasis on the individual will to choose and unite with the divine. So it is this, factor against determinism, against something which is, the one being that is doing some kind of a, self-exploration, rather looking at it as the need or necessity of the individual to deploy the power of divinity within. So it's, the fire is the portion of the sun in the individual. That's the relation between the fire and the sun is really ultimately that which, impels us or propels us towards the divine. And that is basically how the individual is foregrounded in Zoroastrianism. It becomes a kind of a battle in which we have to participate all the time. This understanding is a very important one and has its place, and actually enters into our world in a very prominent way in the kind of debates of modern and just slightly pre-modern philosophers. So we find that two of the greatest thinkers in the Western tradition leading into the modern age are Hegel and Nietzsche, and they represent very well this kind of, duality or dichotomy between a deterministic universe in which the movements of time are being orchestrated by a single consciousness, by the unitary consciousness, by the time spirit, the zeitgeist, and on the other hand, of a universe which is a universe in which the individual is foregrounded as and through the power of will. So we find that very interestingly, Nietzsche, who in some sense contests the Hegelian idea of the cycles and deterministic cosmos, draws upon Zoroastrianism. That's why his primary book is called Thus Spake Zarathustra, in which exactly this kind of a strenuous will to self-exceeding is deployed by the individual in propelling us towards the Superman. So we find that there is a great need in understanding things like that, but we have to also see that the context of this individual movement, the struggle of the individual, it's not a hubris of the individual cut out or cut away from the cosmic self-becoming. But if we think of it as a cosmogenesis, as I mentioned earlier, then the two are related, the two coexist, and also it is the one that has become these two. So that is the way in which Zoroastrianism has lent something essential to our understanding of the individual. So this is the reason why Zoroastrianism lives, one may say, today in the guise of existentialism.
Thank you, Devashish.
Devashish, are there any other existential thinkers that also hark back to Zoroaster?
Not explicitly. There are many thinkers, one may say, who are a little more theologically oriented, who have been excavating Zoroastrianism in our times, but not so explicitly among the rest of the existentialists. However, I would say that Nietzsche's reformulation of Zoroastrianism has had a very, very seminal influence on all philosophy in our times.
Thank you.
Margaret, would you like to start reading?
Okay. Chapter 4, The Divine and the Undivine. The seer, the thinker, the self-existent, who becomes everywhere, has ordered perfectly all things from years septernal. Isha Upanishad. There's a footnote, verse 8. Many purified by knowledge have come to my state of being. They have reached likeness in their law of being to me. Gita, footnote number 2, Roman numeral 4, 10, Roman numeral 14, 2. Know that for the Brahman and not this which men cherish here. Kena Upanishad, footnote number 3, Roman numeral 1.4. One controlling inner self of all beings, as the sun, the eye of the world is not touched by the external faults of vision. So this inner self in beings is not touched by the sorrow of the world. Katha Upanishad, footnote 4, Roman numeral 2, dot 2, 12, comma 11. The Lord abides in the heart of all beings. Gita, footnote number 5, Roman numeral 18.61. The universe is a manifestation of an infinite and eternal all existence. The divine being dwells in all that is. We ourselves are that in ourself, in our deepest being. Our soul, the secret indwelling psychic entity, is a portion of the divine consciousness and essence. This is the view we have taken of our existence, but at the same time we speak of a divine life as the culmination of the evolutionary process, and the use of the phrase implies that our present life is undivine, and all the life too that is below us. At the first glance, this looks like a self-contradiction. Instead of making a distinction between the divine life we aspire for and a present undivine existence, it would be more logical to speak of an ascent from level to higher level of a divine manifestation. It may be admitted that essentially, if we look at the inner reality alone and discount the suggestions of the outer figure, such might be the nature of the evolution, the change we have to undergo in nature. So it would appear perhaps to the impartial eye of a universal vision untroubled by our dualities of knowledge and ignorance, good and evil, happiness and suffering, and participating in the untrammeled consciousness and delight of such an ananda. And yet, from the practical and relative point of view, as distinguished from an essential vision, the distinction between the divine and the undivine has an insistent value, a very pressing significance. This, then, is an aspect of the problem which it is necessary to bring into the light and assess its true importance.
So, we see that he begins the chapter, prefaces the chapter with these quotations, as he always does, and with these quotations he again orients us or prepares us for the kind of meditation that is going to be conducted in this chapter. And so we can look at these quotations, and we see that in these quotations exactly those ideas of the one and the many, and of the eternity of the divine, and of the journey of the individual from a less conscious to a more conscious condition are highlighted. So the first quotation, which is a very powerful quotation from the Isha Upanishad, actually begins by fielding the pre-existent perfection of all reality. It also points to the creation, the way in which the manifestation has appeared. And it does so in a progressive manner, in almost an evolutionary manner, if we look at it as an evolution from the divine to the cosmos, from Brahman to the world. So those terms that it introduces are like a progression. The seer, the thinker, the self-existent who becomes everywhere, those terms are actually given separate names. The seer is the kavi, the thinker is the manishi in that formulation, the self-existent is the swayambhu, and who becomes everywhere is the paribhu, who has gone every, who has become everything. Paribhu, who has gone abroad, has ordered perfectly all things from your sempiternal. In other words, time is being introduced here, but time is being introduced as a eternal perfection. In other words, now what we see is that there is a revelation involved. There is a self-seeing involved. In other words, there is a idea which is pre-existent in the divine that is manifesting. That idea is seen by the seer and it becomes fully idea in the thinking of the thinker. So we find that this thinker, the seer and thinker, are not us as seers and thinkers. It's the divine seer and the divine as thinker. In other words, the thinking of the divine real idea, the supramental thought, by which manifestation is occurring. Swayambhu, the one who is self-becoming, who is manifesting himself, the one who is his in everything as himself, who has become himself, is becoming himself. Paribhu is going forth, is going abroad. And hence there can be nothing that can be unknown or that can be undivine in this movement. This is all divine because it is the divine self-manifestation through his own real idea, through his own self-perception and manifesting the truth of his idea. Yet, we find that the other quotations make more prominent the fact that there is a kind of journey, a kind of choice, center of divinity that we have to keep in mind and separate from the rest. So he says, he talks about the journey in terms of that quotation from the Gita, which occurs twice, and that's the reason why when you read the footnotes of the second footnote, you found that there are two chapters and two verses in which the same quotation occurs. Many purified by knowledge have come to my state of being. So Krishna here is talking about identity. But the kind of identity he's talking about is also very interesting. It's not an identity in which the individual is lost in the divine. It is an identity in which the individual attains likeness of the divine. They have reached likeness in their law of being to me. In other words, the divine self multiplied is evolving to the totality of his integral self-knowledge in each of its multiplied entities. And that journey is what he's feeling. He's saying that there have been those in the past who have followed after this particular goal, the goal of attaining to likeness with me. In other words, becoming in consciousness and reality the law of their being to become one with the divine. The third one says, know that for the Brahman and not this which men cherish here. So here we find that the notion of the divine and the undivine is clearly posed, that in terms of choice, in terms of the fact that at every moment we are faced with this choice of that against this, the present in which there are certain conditions that keep us in ignorance, and a goal, the star towards which we must move by rejecting that which is holding us, fettering us to the ignorance. Then we find, where is the divine center? Because here this is a very important point, is that even if we were to acknowledge that in our practical experience, much is a reality of suffering, of ignorance, of diminished knowledge, of you know, variety of you know, limitations, there is still something divine in us, because if that divine were not present in each individual, we'd only be approximating, we'd only be trying to mentally create various ethical formulations which we take to be the divine, and yet which each has its limitations and therefore does not allow us to attain to the divinity. So that to be found within, and we were talking about Zoroastrianism, in which I was saying that there is the notion of the sun and of fire, the fire which actually burns in every in everything, in every entity, and which is the sun descended into darkness. So we find that that kind of an idea is prevalent throughout the Vedas. The Veda is really a solar mythology. Indra, to whom the maximum number of hymns in the Veda are addressed, is nothing but a solar god who fights under the conditions of the darkness of the ignorance by using the fire, which is the thunder, the fire of lightning and thunder, that has been brought into the ignorance. And the hymns to Agni, which form the other very predominant corpus of Vedic hymns, have all to do with the imminent fire. You know, Indra represents the cosmic fire, the fire that reveals by coming from the cosmos. And Agni represents the imminent fire, the fire present within every being that actually takes us, guides us, leads us infallibly towards the dawning of the solar day, which is the goal of the Veda. So here it says, one controlling inner self of all beings, this antaryamin, of all beings, which is the antaratma of the Gita, the Atman within of the Gita. This is actually the fire within, the psychic fire. As the sun, the eye of the world, is not touched by the external faults of vision, so this inner self in beings is not touched by the sorrow of the world. In other words, there is something totally divine within us that the undivine cannot touch. We are already divine in that respect. So that is a linchpin. That is something which already shows to us a resolution to this problem of the divine and the undivine. There is the divine already present in all things, yet there appears to be the sense of something undivine which we need to purify so that we experience the divine. So with that, Sri Aurobindo gives us this first paragraph, in which he first connects the previous chapter to this chapter. He summarizes, even, one may say, the previous chapter in that first line: the universe is a manifestation of an infinite and eternal all existence. The divine being dwells in all that is. We ourselves are that in ourselves, in our own deepest being. Our soul, the secret indwelling psychic entity, is a portion of the divine consciousness and essence. This also is almost like a summary of the Katha Upanishad, the quote. I missed the last one, which is from the Gita. The Lord abides in the heart of all things, which in a very simple way reinforces that idea. So this is the view we have taken of our existence. But at the same time, we speak of a divine life as the culmination of the evolutionary process, which is something that he has introduced earlier. But in the entire chapter previous to this, he has not introduced the idea of the undivine. And that's the reason why it's important for him here to bring that out. This is almost like a kind of a, you know, move from the Hegelian to the Nietzschean view of things, that the cosmos exists in its perfection and in its unfolding, yet the individual is faced with a journey in which choices have to be made and the undivine overcome. So that's why he says, at first glance, this looks like a self-contradiction. What is the undivine? Can we look at it instead as a not a kind of a duality, but a kind of a gradation, a gradation of truth, a movement from level to level of our divine manifestation? And that is exactly what that first quote is talking about. It is true, and that's one way of looking at things which also we need to internalize. And that's why he says that that is the divine truth, that is the divine way of looking at things. Were we to have a purely impersonal view of things, if we look at the inner reality alone and discount the suggestions of the outer figure, so it may be that whatever is telling us that things are undivine is this outer figure. The appearance is giving us these suggestions. But if we were to ignore those suggestions and find another kind of vision, we'd see that that is not the truth, that in fact everything is divine, only there are gradations of divinity, gradations of consciousness, and we are traveling those gradations. Now, this is true, but as he's going to point out, if we take that view in our present existence, it is a view that belongs to the notion that there is only ignorance, but no falsehood, because the struggle of the human will is not understood in that particular formulation. So it would appear perhaps to the impartial eye of a universal vision, untroubled by our dualities of knowledge and ignorance, good and evil, happiness and suffering, and participating in the untrammeled consciousness and delight of Satchidananda. To Satchidananda, it is all very well. It is the Satchidananda self-vision of things that is perfect at all times. And yet, due to the fact that we find ourselves within the limitations of our, even if we call it a gradation of consciousness, we find that that in itself creates conditions that bind us to a struggle. And so he says, from the practical and relative point of view, as distinguished from an essential vision, the distinction between the divine and the undivine has an insistent value, a very pressing significance. This is the problem which is necessary to bring into the light and assess its true importance. So that is what he's setting up to do.
A question, Debashish, if I may.
Yes, Mr.
The sense of, and this is just such an incredible passage, these quotations, the focus of the light, of aspiration, which rises up, that Agni, fire, which is always rising up higher and higher. And the sense that, at least in perhaps, and forgive my, much of my ignorance here with regard to the Vedas, but that the sun stands sort of even higher. I mean, the light of the sun shines from beyond. Mm-hmm. And just a sense of that rising aspiration. And could you, is there any suggestion or thought of these two, of this sort of these two different lights, this aspiration that is entered into perhaps the darkness, the undivine, and then this light that we are aspiring to, or perhaps it's beyond light. Just a thought.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look at the Veda, simplify the Veda to its kind of primary mythos, then it is really about the immanence of the sun. The sun that sets actually is an image of the immanence of this solar consciousness in a darkness. It is the sacrifice of the Purusha. It is the way by which the one who is all conscious and all knowing, the two kinds of lights that you talked about, or the two kinds of fire that you talked about, the solar fire or the solar light, is not something that, moves by finite steps to illuminate the territory, but it territorializes all at once. When the sun shines, when the sun rises, everything is illuminated all at once. So it is an ontology. It is not an ontic condition. You see, it's an ontology which creates a state of being that is already completely illuminated. It is enlightened. It is the enlightened ontology, you may say. And on the other hand, to bring that about, it has created a certain kind of a journey, and that journey is one of its self-manifestations. That is the cosmic self-manifestation in which we find ourselves, an evolutionary ignorance. The evolutionary ignorance proceeds towards an apotheosis of the sun rising. And it does that due to the internal dynamics of the fire that is immanent within it. And that fire is immanent in two ways. It's the cosmic fire of the lightning within the ignorance that shows up tracks of light, brings knowledge, but finite knowledge, to the human. And at the same time, destroys the constraining powers of the darkness. And so that's the whole thing about the battle that is going on, which is a battle due to the darkness having its own power, its own will to remain dark. These are the robbers of the light. The light that has become immanent is kept robbed in the dark cave of the asuras. And it is the fire that breaks these dark places. It's the lightning that breaks these dark places. Indra breaks the cavern and releases the light. You know, again, it's very interesting that we find in Japan a similar mythology of the sun goddess that is locked in the cave. Amaterasu is locked in the cave. And pushes the boulder has to be pushed aside, both by the effort of the gods as well as by herself, and she comes out and everything gets illuminated. So it is this self-emergence aided by the journey of the creatures who have to struggle against the very real constraining powers of the darkness to remain in the dark, which constitutes the nature of fire as a limiting instrument, a limited instrument, and the nature of the sun, which at a certain point throws aside the cloak of darkness and creates a new condition of being.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Sure. So we see actually even in those two images that you pointed out, Justin, the two kinds of fire or two kinds of light that you pointed out, the divine and the divine in the undivine, the divine as a eternal condition of truth and divinity. And the divine as a temporal condition of the journey towards divinity. I think these two are the two ontologies, the ontologies of vidya and avidya that are the case in our experience, our lives, and the evolutionary ignorance.
I was thinking of this undivine as something that has been, can we say that it has actually been uttered by divine himself? Like, you know, I am not, or this self-forgetting, you know, something like that.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. That's the only resolution. Otherwise, we are left with the dualism of the Zoroastrians. Otherwise, we are left with a condition in which there is a duality at the base of the cosmos. That there is eternally two separate powers, good and evil. But no, there must be, exactly as you said, a self-uttering, a self-negation. By the divine himself, the sun itself that has become the night. You know, and so that's why the Vedas talk about the two mothers, day and night. And so this night, this self-denial, self-oblivion, the self-oblivion precedes the self-denial. The self-oblivion is God's negation of himself. The self-denial is the conscious force that keeps that self-oblivion in place. So these are certainly powers of God. This is the reason why, and again we were talking about the influence of Zoroastrianism in Christianity. Again we find that this self-oblivion is caused, the fall in the Christian mythos is caused by an original sin. While if there is any original sin in the Hindu view of things, it is really God's own original sin. Brahma himself lies in all the Puranic myths, which is a way of saying that it is the Supreme himself that denies his own reality, so that the sacrifice of Purusha may occur and a certain kind of experience unfold, the experience of the evolving ignorance.
Beautiful, thank you. If I may ask or inquire one more question, please.
Yeah, sure.
There are a couple of places here where there it's speaking about the sense of the inner self, and I have the strong sense of interiority as a first step in a yogic practice, that there is even an acknowledgement of an interior state, and I just was wondering if you could see any of those sort of elements of interiorization in this approach, which of course is ultimately integral. It becomes inward and outward, but there seem to be some strong statements about the interior here.
Yes, I completely agree, Justin, and I'm glad you brought that to the front. And yes, absolutely, even in the quotations that are given and in this very first paragraph, we see that even to grapple with this question, one needs to interiorize. And this interiority ultimately must bring us into contact with that fire that is within. It is only then that this question starts being addressable. Otherwise, we are caught in appearances, and it is impossible to make any headway in this what he's calling the undivine condition. If it is only external at this point, it is something which subjects us to the self-denial of being, to the oblivion of being.
Thank you.
Joanna, would you like to read next?
Okay. The distinction between the divine and the undivine life is in fact identical with the root distinction between a life of knowledge lived in self-awareness and in the power of the light and a life of ignorance. At any rate, it so presents itself in a world that is slowly and with difficulty evolving out of an original inconscience. All life that has still this inconscience for its basis is stamped with the mark of a radical imperfection. For even if it is satisfied with its own type, it is a satisfaction with something incomplete and inharmonious, a patchwork of discords. On the contrary, even a purely mental or vital life might be perfect within its limits if it were based on a restricted but harmonious self-power and self-knowledge. It is this bondage to a perpetual stamp of imperfection and disharmony that is the mark of the undivine. A divine life, on the contrary, even if progressing from the little to the more, would be at each stage harmonious in its principle and detail. It would be a secure ground upon which freedom and perfection could naturally flower or grow towards their highest stature, refine and expand into their most subtle opulence. All imperfections, all perfections have to be taken into view in our consideration of the difference between an undivine and a divine existence. But ordinarily, when we make the distinction, we do it as human beings struggling under the pressure of life and the difficulties of our conduct amidst its immediate problems and perplexities. Most of all, we are thinking of the distinction we are obliged to make between good and evil, or of that along with its kindred problem of the duality, the blendedness of happiness and suffering. When we seek intellectually for a divine presence in things, a divine origin of the world, a divine government of its workings, the presence of evil, the insistence on suffering, the large, the enormous part offered to pain, grief, and affliction in the economy of nature are the cruel phenomena which battle our reason and overcome the instinctive faith of mankind in such an origin and government, or in an all-seeing, all-determining, and omnipresent divine immanence. Other difficulties we could solve more easily and happily, and make some shift to be better satisfied with the ready conclusiveness of our solutions. But this standard of judgment is not sufficiently comprehensive, and it is supported upon a too human point of view. For to a wider outlook, Evil and suffering appear only as a striking aspect. They are not the whole defect, not even the root of the matter. The sum of the world's imperfections is not made up only of these two deficiencies. There is more than the fall, if fall there was, of our spiritual or material being from good and from happiness, or our nature's failure to overcome evil and suffering. Besides the deficiency of the ethical and hedonistic satisfactions demanded by our being, the paucity of good and delight in our world experience, there is also the deficiency of other divine degrees, for knowledge, truth, beauty, power, unity are, they too, the stuff and elements of a divine life, and these are given to us in a scanty and grudging measure, yet all are in their absolute powers of the divine nature.
So here he is laying out what is the undivine, and as he points out over here that what marks the undivine is this bondage to imperfection and disharmony. It is this bondage to a perpetual stamp of imperfection and disharmony that is the mark of the undivine. So he sees, essentially, this is the condition in which we find ourselves. And if, on the other hand, as he says, a divine life, on the contrary, even if progressing from the little to the more, would be at each stage harmonious in its principle and detail, it would be a secure ground upon which freedom and perfection could naturally flower or grow towards their highest stature, refine and expand into their most subtle opulence. In other words, there may be degrees of not degrees of perfection, but degrees of the expression of perfection. And so we can find that certain things already, even in their modest scale, carry a certain stamp of divinity. And yet there are other larger entities that carry an even greater stamp of divinity. It is as if the power of divinity has manifestations along different levels or grades of being, degrees of being. This is the characteristic of what one might call a movement within the supermind. If there was to be a certain kind of evolution in the supermind, because after all, we may say that time movement is not necessarily a movement of evolution from a self-loss to a self-finding through struggle, which against all odds. It may also be a kind of time movement in which the powers of the divine are manifesting in a gradual fashion, but in a harmonious fashion. So this is the whole thing about imperfection and disharmony, as he called this fact that there are certain additional powers that have been added to this self-forgetting, which make it a struggle and which confront us always with imperfection and disharmony. If we may think about a degree of perfection, something like a very perfect flower manifests a degree of perfection, we may say. But if we were to think about disharmony, it is as if there is a certain attempt to build even the smallest degree of perfection, and we can't achieve it. We end up with something that looks ugly, that cannot give us that sense of the perfection of things. So this is the main problem. if we were to have a kind of a graduated, sort of manifestation in which the divine travels harmoniously from stage to stage in time or through time, that would be a certain kind of time manifestation. And this is indeed what the manifestation in the supermind is, a cosmic manifestation in the supermind. But there is an added element in our evolving ignorance in which the power to attain divinity is tested. In other words, it is also an evolution of power. It is not merely an evolution within the ignorance, but it is an evolution that struggles to become divine. And so he starts by talking about that is an essential difference. We may also relate that difference to the difference between ignorance and falsehood. Just a pure ignorance without falsehood would mean that as we gain knowledge, our ignorance disappears. It is only a gradual process, but a process which is without any resistance, one may say, without any struggle, without any complete loss, so that there is a complete approximation at every step, a trial and error that meets more with failure than with success. On the other hand, if there is a power of resistance so strong that it completely baffles our attempts at perfection, then we can talk about a falsehood. There is something active against that drive to attain to even the smallest perfection. So that is one of the really important factors prevailing here. On the other hand, he's also saying that our primary understanding of the undivine seems to come from these experiences of suffering and of unhappiness, suffering and pain and evil, of the cruel phenomenon. It says pain, grief, and affliction. The enormous part offered by pain, grief, and affliction in the economy of nature are the cruel phenomena which baffle our reason and overcome the instinctive faith of mankind in such an origin and government, or in an all-seeing, all-determining, and omnipresent divine immanence. See, so where is that truth that is expressed in that quotation from the Isha Upanishad, that the seer, the thinker, the self-existent has ordered perfectly all things from years sempiternal? There doesn't seem to be that. This also is related to the contention of Nietzsche against Hegel, who was saying that there is almost an automatic, determined process through which the world is progressing, through the kind of bringing into relation of contradictions and their overcoming through a certain kind of synthesis through time. And it's an automatic process that's going on in the cosmic cycles. And he was to say that we see no such thing. What we see, rather, what we experience, is a very, very trenchant struggle, a radical struggle of the human being, of the human will, to exceed the conditions in which it finds itself. So this is the point he's making. And then the other point he's pointing out is that though this is what it starts from, and that's the reason why the Buddha, for example, there's an interesting quotation which is attributed to Buddha in one of the Mahayana texts, which says that the Buddha said when he attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, the aspects of truth were as multiple, as many as the leaves on the Bodhi tree. It was a splendor that is unimaginable. But what he was bringing to people were only two of the leaves of that Bodhi tree, suffering and desire. These are the only two, because these two are the ones that confront us most, insistently. They are the face of the undivine to us. Yet, one may say as many leaves as there are to the Bodhi tree are the faces of perfection that are all imperfect here. And that's the point he's making, that it is not just the deficiency of suffering and evil, or suffering and desire, but it's the deficiency or of the ethical and hedonistic satisfactions, as he says here, the paucity of good and delight. There is also the deficiency of other divine degrees, knowledge, truth, beauty, power, unity. All these are, these characteristics of the divine life that are scanty over here. He uses the beautiful poetic phrase, these are given to us in a scanty and grudging measure, yet all are in their absolute powers of the divine nature. So there is a even greater way in which we have to see this from the integral point of view. It is not merely a question of suffering and desire, but it is the imperfection in all the divine attributes that we have to approach. And particularly, the question of power is really the central question. That's why Nietzsche also struck upon that. It is the will to power, because it is power that is evolving through the resistance of falsehood. If that was not one of the divine powers that was involved, then it could have been what he was saying, a kind of a natural increase in knowledge through time.
John Robert, would you like to read next?
Yes, I'd be happy to. It is not possible, then, to limit the description of our and the world's undivine perfection solely to moral evil or sensational suffering. There is more in the world enigma than their double problem, for they are only two strong results of a common principle. It is the general principle of imperfection that we have to admit and consider. If we look closely at this general imperfection, we shall see that it consists first in a limitation in us of the divine elements which robs them of their divinity, then in a various many-branching distortion, a perversion, a contrary turn, a falsifying departure from some ideal truth of being. To our minds, which do not possess that truth, but can conceive it, this departure presents itself either as a state from which we have lapsed spiritually, or as a possibility or promise which we cannot fulfill, cannot realize, because it exists only as an ideal. There has been either a lapse of the inner spirit from a greater consciousness and knowledge, delight, love and beauty, power and capacity, harmony and good, or else there is a failure of our struggling nature,
an impotence to achieve what we instinctively see to be divine and desirable. If we penetrate to the cause of the fall or the failure, we shall find that all proceeds from the one primal fact that our being, consciousness, force, experience of things, represent, not in their very self, but in their surface pragmatic nature, a principle or an effective phenomenon of division or rupture in the unity of the divine existence. This division becomes, in its inevitable practical effect, a limitation of the divine consciousness and knowledge, the divine delight and beauty, the divine power and capacity, the divine harmony and good. There is a limitation of completeness and wholeness, a blindness in our vision of these things, a lameness in our following of them, in our experience of them, a fragmentation, a diminution of power and intensity, a lowering of quality. The mark of a descent from spiritual heights, or else of a consciousness emerging from the insensible, neutral monotone of the unconscious. The intensities which are normal and natural on higher ranges are in us lost or toned down so as to harmonize with the blacks and grays of our material existence. There arises, too, by a secondary ulterior effect, a perversion of these highest things. In our limited mentality, unconsciousness and wrong consciousness intervene. Ignorance covers our whole nature, and by the misapplication or misdirection of an imperfect will and knowledge, by automatic reactions of our diminished consciousness force, and the inept poverty of our substance, contradictions of the divine elements are formed. Incapacity, inertia, falsehood, error, pain and grief, wrongdoing, discord, evil. There is, too, always, somewhere hidden in ourselves, nursed in our recesses, even when not overtly felt in the conscious nature, even when rejected by the parts of us which these things torture, an attachment to this experience of division, a clinging to the divided way of being, which prevents the excision of these unhappinesses or their rejection and removal. For since the principle of consciousness, force, and ananda is at the root of all manifestation, nothing can endure if it has not a will in our nature, a sanction of the purusha, a sustained pleasure in some part of the being, even though it be a secret or a perverse pleasure, to keep it in continuance.
So this is a very powerful paragraph in which he gives clear shape to the idea that he is putting forth, which is again this notion of what is the root or origin of the state of general imperfection in which we find ourselves, and what keeps it in place. And here he feels the idea of the fall. So he's pointing to, this is one of the primary theological conceptions that exist in almost every religion in some way or form. The idea that there is a perfect condition from which we have fallen into a condition of ignorance and suffering. and of the diminishment of all the divine powers, a general condition, as he says, of imperfection. So either there is that, or there is a duality, that there is a perfect, there is a sky with a sun up there, and struggling beings down here, that are constantly striving to attain to the conditions that their intuitions and imaginations give them evidence, but who cannot reach there because a radical duality separates them from that. So these are two kinds of views that arise out of this condition, the condition of experiencing a general imperfection, yet having the intuition of a perfection. One may say that even to have the intuition of a perfection within us implies a kind of memory, implies a kind of immanence of that which we attempt to achieve. Now, if that memory is a memory of something without an immanence within us, if it is just a memory of something related to a fall, then try as we might, we will never be able to reach there. We will only approximate. We will not be able to deploy the power of consciousness that is native to the condition from which we fell. We will have to rely on avatars, for example, to suddenly make things happen. This is what the Christian mythos does. But if that is within us, then there is a certain kind of dynamic that is set up through which every individual is in a process from life to life of attaining that condition, individually and collectively. The whole cosmos is in that condition. So what is the root of that condition? And here is where Sri Aurobindo makes that clear distinction between ignorance and falsehood, as we may say. And he points to the two factors involved there. Firstly, there is the factor of the ignorance. There is the factor, and he proceeds to do this in a kind of a quasi-empirical way, that this is our experience. The division becomes, in its inevitable practical effect, he says, a limitation of the divine consciousness and knowledge, the divine delight and beauty, the divine power and capacity, the divine harmony and good. There is a limitation of completeness and wholeness, a blindness in our vision of these things, a lameness in our following of them, in our experience of them, a fragmentation, a diminution of power and intensity, a lowering of quality, the mark of a descent from spiritual heights, or else of a consciousness emerging from the insensible, neutral monotone of the inconscience. So he's pointing to both those views, one of a descent or the other of an ascent out of a kind of a radical sleep, radical death of inconscience. And in either case, we are talking about two factors, two primary aspects of this ontology. One is the aspect of a gradation of consciousness that has plunged into oblivion, plunged into inconscience. And the other of a fragmentation, as he's saying, the power of division by which even whatever may appear from that inconscience cannot retain the semblance of unity. These are the primary ways in which the power of, the divine are falsified by our experience. And then he points to the even greater hints, to the even greater problem that keeps this in place as a almost a will of the divine, a perverse will. And as he points out, everything is a manifestation of delight. Again, in doing this, he is taking the Vedantic view or the Upanishadic view that out of delight all is born, by delight it is maintained, and into delight it returns. So even this inconscience and this struggle and harm and disharmony in which we find ourselves is born out of a decision of the divine, which is marked by delight, marked by bliss. Because it is by bliss that the divine forgets himself. It is an act of bliss by which the divine decides to undertake this sacrifice of the Purusha, and out of which it will emerge as a collective realization. And so that divine delight that has gone into its self-denial is a perverse delight. It's a delight that is operating in reverse, and therefore that is perverse. And that's what keeps this manifestation at a certain level, upheld by the sanction of the cosmic Purusha, to deny its limitation, to deny its, you know, its movement out of the limitation, so that it remains, as it were, something gives us perverse delight. We experience that at the individual level by the perverse delight somewhere in the secret recesses of our being, as he says, you know, darkness lurks somewhere in the heart of man. And this darkness is not of our creation. This darkness is the divine delight that has gone into its self-denial so as to make possible the struggle of existence and the emergence of the divine out of the darkness. This is the basis of falsehood in this ignorant cosmos.
Again, one of those very poetic type paragraphs that you just enjoy, right?
Yeah, it's poetic, but it's also very, very powerful, because I think the ideas in it are very, very potent, where he's talking about, he's clearing some very difficult ground, yes, some very contradictory ideas, because to take it that even our experience, not merely of ignorance, which may be thought of as a kind of a self-oblivion of the divine, but the self-denial of the divine is an act of joy that is dynamic and that is present in all things as a perverse reality, you know, an amoral delight, a delight that we have to look at outside of the boundaries of human ethics, and yet that we have to fight against, but at the same time acknowledge, is what is being talked about here. It's very knotty and complex idea that he's presenting here.
It may be a little bit off the track, but can you say a few words, like why we feel something as poetic, all of us at the same time? Like, what is it that we really experience?
I think it is the power of language. I think, firstly, I think it is the complexity of the idea and his ability to express it in this language which brings it forward with such clarity, and at the same time that gives it a certain kind of a, you know, meaning, that it's so difficult to put these ideas in words, and he does this with such felicity, using a power of language that is at the same time extremely elevated and complex.
Given it's 9:35, maybe we can stop for today and continue next time.
Sure.
So, I'll upload the recording soon. We'll stop for today and continue next time. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Desmond.
Thanks, everybody.
Yeah,
thank you, Desmond.
Joanna had a question.
Yeah, let's do that.
It's a logistical question. I had some problems with my Skype, and I'd like to be able to listen to the tape of this portion that I missed before we do the next session. So I'm wondering who actually posts those tapes.
I post them. Sham, kind of makes it available. I'm also keeping a kind of a second level of recording, and then both I and Keka post it on two different sites.
Yeah, but actually she's right. You probably forgot to post the 12th December.
Oh, I didn't post the previous one?
It's not on there.
Okay, so I shall do that today itself. I'll post both today's and last time's.
Yeah, recording. After you do that, then I can copy.
Sure.
But if it's possible, could they be posted, like well before the next?
Yes, usually I do that, but due to a variety of things, it slipped my mind last time. So yeah, we'll make sure that happens.
Thank you. And I'm on another topic. I'm going to send you an email on the intuition stuff because I'd like to communicate.
Sure, we can communicate on that.
Okay, great. Thank you, everybody.
Okay, thank you, and have a wonderful new year.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Yeah. And we'll convene again in the new year for the next meeting. And I see that Joanna has some birds that are kind of participating vociferously.
Yes.
They're having fun this morning. They're just enjoying themselves a lot.
Okay, good.
Is that the one which is in your picture?
Well, I have two parrots, an Amazon and an African Grey. My Amazon's 41st birthday is January.
And
my African Grey is 11 and a half. And my African Grey is whistling away, and they talk to each other.
Okay. Nice. Okay.
Happy New Year, everyone.
Happy New Year. Bye-bye.
Happy New Year. Okay, bye.